This podcast is brought to you by the RNIB Children, Young People, Families and Education team in partnership with Fight Against Blindness. It's part of the Emotional Support series. This information will be useful for parents, carers and professionals who work with children with vision impairment and may also be useful for young people themselves.
Hi everyone and welcome to this episode in our series on mental health. Today's episode will focus on talking to others about your child's eye condition. I'm joined today by Ian from Fight Against Blindness and Craig from our Children and Families team. Hi Ian.
Good morning Laura, it's good to be with you again.
Great, great. Ian, for those who don't know a little bit about FAB, would you mind explaining your role and what FAB do?
Sure, yeah. So I'm a clinical psychologist and I work at Oxford Children's Hospital. And as part of my role there, the charity Fight Against Blindness, or FAB, they fund me to see children that have eye conditions or visual impairment. And FAB do this with a number of psychologists throughout the country, actually. I think we are a small team, but growing in number, four or five of us now, maybe even five or six. So we are amongst the very few psychologists who work very specifically with children with visual impairments.
And Craig as well. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Laura. How are we doing?
Great. So in today's episode, we're going to explore some of the challenges that people have around talking to others about their child's eye condition. So Ian, I suppose one of the best place to start would be, and it is quite common that families will ask us about this as well, is maybe people commenting in public, where people might come up and ask questions. Often sometimes the child might hear it, and for a parent in that moment, I think sometimes it's very difficult to know how exactly to deal with that situation.
Yeah, I mean it's potentially pretty horrible, isn't it? You're kind of walking around Tesco or whatever, minding your own business, and then someone comes up and ask the question, you know, what's happened to your child's eyes, what's going on? And you know, this is obviously a complete intrusion, and it can be really upsetting for the parent, of course, and it's not unreasonable that the child would pick up on that and feel pretty upset too. So this is something that I think happens, I would say, unfortunately, probably all too frequently, and I guess there's a couple of different ways to address it now. Laura, that type of example, the idea that it's kind of random people coming up and being, I think if we're being charitable, kind of a bit clumsy, is that the sort of thing that you guys hear a bit about?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it definitely, where people would either be, you know, asking questions or even staring, and it can be a really uncomfortable experience for a family.
Mm. Yeah, and I guess, you know, by all means, if this happens, it's entirely legitimate, particularly if the child isn't terribly upset by it, or in fact is entirely oblivious to it, just to perhaps not to ignore it exactly, but to, in terms of communicating it with the child, not attending to it a great deal. Clearly, if your child's upset, though, it's an opportunity, I think. I know that when we talked about meltdowns and things, I try to frame stuff and incidents that can be really tricky as maybe being a bit of an opportunity to try and teach something or do something that could actually be quite useful. And I guess if this has happened, your child's a bit upset, maybe there's a chance here to determine what they think just happened, so the child's understanding of that interaction, and also to check in a bit about their understanding of their own eye condition, their own VI, what they think about it. And I guess in of itself, that can be super useful. In the moment, it can also be really useful in terms of their adjustment to that eye condition going forward and their emotional adjustment more generally. So it's tricky. Like the first step in any of these things is usually, as the parent, can you sort of maintain your own cool? There's been this intrusion, and again, you know, we'll assume it was meant, no harm was intended, albeit it was an intrusion nonetheless. Well, what you need to try and do, I guess, if your child's upset under those circumstances, is try and model being calm and everything kind of being okay. So you're embodying that actually your child has nothing to be ashamed of, that this is not something they've done, that actually they're not the odd one out here. This person has intruded upon or asked this question unbidden. They've involved themselves. But actually, as a sort of second step, trying to model that that's not necessarily a threat. So again, I'm giving them plenty of latitude in this example. I'm presuming that actually they're just curious and a bit clumsy. But taking that tack and presuming that and modeling that to your child can be mega helpful. So presuming this person isn't mean or hostile and modeling that perhaps they're just a bit curious and they want to understand, oh, you know, this person, they've asked this question because they don't really understand. Maybe they've not met somebody like this. So perhaps they want to kind of ask a few questions and they want to know better because they're really interested. Taking that tack is sending a fairly strong message to your child. Actually, again, you know, we're okay. We're in Tesco, we're in the post office, we're wherever we are. And while this person has involved themselves, initially we feel a bit shaken by that. Actually, this is okay. The person's curious, they want to understand, they're not mean. And again, we're sort of modelling that the world is a safe and generally speaking predictable environment to be in. And that's hopefully going to be super, super helpful to them too. So a real opportunity there. And this is really contingent, I guess, on parents managing to sort of keep their cool with this stuff because it's upsetting and frustrating and infuriating to be intruded on like this. But actually, it's a teaching opportunity. So can we show the child the world is okay, things are predictable, these people are well-intentioned despite them being intrusive, and can we use it as an opportunity to ask questions, check in about their understanding, and teach them perhaps a little bit more about their VI or their eye condition. So as annoying as it might be, as frustrating as it probably is, try and treat it as an opportunity.
So I guess really trying to find the positives in the situation. I mean, following on from that, Ian, following on from the people being curious and sometimes clumsy, we often hear from parents that about misconceptions in terms of what a vision impairment actually is, whether that be people saying to parents, your child's fine, as they're wearing glasses to see, so it should be corrected, or that your child can't be blind because they're walking about, and that kind of misconception of what it means to actually be a registered blind. How would you recommend parents deal with those kind of misconceptions?
Yeah, so I mean, like, the description you've given, I guess you guys might encounter this fairly often. It's certainly something that comes up really often for many of the children and young people that I see. That it could be family members. In fact, it could be family members not really understanding how someone's vision is affected. You know, you hear stuff quite often like, you know, you wouldn't know to look at them that something's up, or you wouldn't know to look at them that their vision is less than perfect. The thing about the glasses, Craig, that you mentioned actually comes up time and time again. There's a presumption that if someone's wearing glasses, the glasses have entirely corrected whatever visual issues they may have. And as a result, I guess, you know, it can be a bit of a, for lots of people, weirdly, a bit of a red herring. They see glasses, they presume actually someone's vision has been entirely corrected by that. So that can be a bit of an issue in of itself. So family members could be doing this, could be teachers, could be friends, could be all sorts of people in someone's life asking these questions, having misconceptions sort of presented. And I guess there's lots of ways, I think, probably to try and address those. So there's, in the first instance, I guess, it's about acknowledging the fact, like you said, Craig, people in the general population, generally speaking, don't understand what we mean by visual impairment. I mean, to them, this may mean someone needs to have glasses. Their vision is impaired. And Craig, I think you mentioned it as well, that, you know, the word blind or the word blindness in the general population, again, not terrifically well understood. So the idea of either your vision is pretty much perfect or your vision is entirely absent. And actually, there are very few increments in between the two. So when family members or classmates or teachers or whomever are engaging with somebody who has a VI, often they are engaging from a position of just really not knowing enough for a kickoff. So there's some people, their visual impairment may be relatively evident to the uninitiated or the outsider. Some people, of course, like you mentioned, it's essentially entirely invisible. You know, it's only through interacting with someone or them discussing it with you that you would have any inkling they have a visual impairment at all. So dealing with that basic, fundamental, very common misunderstanding is step one, right? So if somebody's important, if it's a classmate, I guess, of the child or a teacher particularly that you want to understand better, or a family member, I guess there's different tools you can reach for. Now, there are resources that RNIB have. There are resources on websites and other places, I guess, which try to model what a visual impairment would be like to experience. You guys at the RNIB, have you signposted people towards any good resources or any good tools that people can use to show that?
Yeah, so there's lots of information available on different eye conditions on the RNIB website, and we'll link obviously below this podcast as well. We'll put some links up for more resources for parents as well.
Okay, great. I mean, clearly any resource is an amazing start, right? If you can point somebody towards something, a website address, if you can print something out and hand it to someone, then immediately we're kind of taking steps towards addressing the misconceptions that they have. There are a couple of websites that can be fairly useful. There's one called See Now, so seenow.org, I think, which essentially what it does is it uses your mobile phone camera to simulate what different sight conditions might be like to experience. So I think there's macular degeneration. I think there's diabetic retinopathy. I think there's a couple other ones. So not a lot on that one. It's good because it's kind of techie and I think reasonably accessible to people, and it uses the real world environment in a way which I think is quite meaningful. So of course, since you're using your camera on your mobile phone, people can stick a bit of text in front of it or a computer screen, put the website on it, and then they can see actually what it would be like to try and use that website if they had one of these conditions. It doesn't have a huge range of conditions, although it's fair to say it is only four. There are websites like the RNIB one, I'm sure, lots of images of how it would be to have different eye conditions and see a set image. Static ones, I think, are always a bit less useful, perhaps, than videos. Some of the videos are pretty good, but a bit wonky. There's one on YouTube by a group called Vision Aware. So it's if you just search on YouTube for vision simulations, I think, or visual impairment simulations, it'll come up. The Vision Aware one's one of the best ones. It's a bit 1990s, I think, in terms of its production. So it's not super zingy or techy. I don't think it's mega user friendly for children to use. So if a child's trying to direct a classmate to something that would make sense to them, actually the Vision Aware video is probably not the best one in the whole world, but it does have more diagnoses. It does have retinitis pigmentosa, it does have macular degeneration, it does have a few other ones too. So these sort of tools are quite good. You know, information sheet is good, pictures digitally modified so that someone can experience a bit more what it's like to have visual impairment, a bit better, but the videos better still. And I think the website stroke app stuff in terms of interactivity and use for a child best probably. So these are all useful. The reality is they can't really accurately simulate one specific person's vision, because that, you know, that person's vision is going to deviate in any number of different ways from what the website or the information leaflet is trying to show. So, you know, the visual field will be wrong, the acuity will be wrong, the colour or lack of in the image won't be right, but they're a good start, right? I mean, even old school stuff, like the old school eye chart is a start. You know, it's you know, seeing to what level you can read, and if you can print one out and stick it up on a wall, at least a child and a member of their family or parent can use that as a bit of a learning tool. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a decision, I guess, that to be made with the child, of course. You know, how much do they understand? How much understanding do they think the other person needs to have? That could range very little, actually, to, you know, they want them to be as well informed as humanly possible. And, you know, the family one, I think, is often the first step. You know, can the child feel comfortable at home with the people that are around them? or other siblings, other parents, presuming perhaps they can do tasks they can't? Is there frustration or tension or falling out happening because there's a presumption that you can do a certain task or you can contribute to the household by doing this specific chore or this specific thing, but actually it's impossible? There are examples I can think of where, for example, young people don't want to go to big family gatherings that are happening in big rooms with not terrific lighting, and actually their condition means they can't see people's faces with any great acuity. And as a consequence, people are saying hello to them, presuming that they'll recognise them. When they don't, it could be perceived as a bit of a slight, or the young person is worried it could be perceived as a slight, and as a consequence, they're not going. And then if it's not well understood why they're not going, and the sight condition or the visual impairment is not well understood, then the tensions can kind of creep in, and this could be within the family system or just for the child themselves. So finding some way that they can communicate with people that is acceptable to them is kind of fundamentally the most important thing. And if there's a tool around, a leaflet, you know, a website, video, app, brilliant. If there's not, or even if there is actually, helping a child to draw something up themselves. So, you know, in the past, I've sat down with information from ophthalmologists and optometrists and a child, and me and them have put our relatively naive heads together and looked at this, you know, medical techie sort of information. And with their report of how they engage with the world, we've cobbled together a couple of paragraphs. And once the child or the teenager is happy with those, then they may feel they want to print them out and give them to the teachers or the teaching assistants at school by way of saying, look, actually, I think you need to know this stuff, particularly if there's a new school or changing year or changing teachers. Here's the means through which I'm going to communicate it. And of course, that child taking ownership of it is super useful too. So I think those are sort of important first steps. I think, you know, if they can, use a resource that's already available. And if not, and potentially even if they can, actually draw up something themselves to start trying to chip away at the understandable but often frustrating misconceptions that people have.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite interesting as well, what you're saying about, obviously, you know, some of the things that when you were saying about the family gatherings, for example, because quite often, you know, if a child has vision loss from birth, they don't have anything to compare it to. Mm. So the child might not necessarily be aware themselves that this is actually the reason that they don't like this situation. And they might not be able to kind of articulate that because they don't really have anything else to compare it to. It's kind of just, you know, always been that way. So do you think it's in terms then for children and even parents, like even maybe practicing how to explain the condition as well, so that they have something there to pull out when kind of in that position?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. There is often, I think, justifiable anxiety from parents and from children themselves of what am I going to say when someone asks me? You know, when someone notices or you know, a teacher reads a letter from the Senko or from a doctor or whatever, and they then ask me about the diagnosis, what am I going to say? And the anxiety around that in of itself, just not knowing, can almost be as much as the anxiety around having that conversation itself. So just rehearsing something, I mean, that could take the form, like I said, of having something typed out and printed, you know, a bit of paper or an email or something that the child can share or send or give to the people involved in their education or in their family life. But equally, it could just be, particularly for younger kids, more appropriate just to have a phrase. You know, I have an eye condition, it means this. You know, I have a visual impairment, it means this. Or, you know, I have retinitis pigmentosa, it means that this. Just something, you know, as simple as needs to be and as complicated as a child feels is appropriate or feels comfortable with, that once they have that and it's in their toolbox, then you know, you practice it in a family member or an aunt or uncle or a grandparent or sibling or whomever, and know that actually they can be confident, at least if someone asks an initial question or maybe even a couple of questions, they'll have enough rehearsed so they know what they're going to say. And hopefully in doing so, this whole subject of, you know, addressing this or answering the questions of people who don't know stuff can get just that little bit easier. So yeah, I think a really good idea, Laura, good point. Practicing something verbal or written or whatever format they want to do it in is super important just to give them that confidence.
And I guess in terms of the, as you said, the anxiety that parents or children can feel when telling people, from RNIB's point of view, a few years back we were getting a lot of calls from parents who were concerned about their children going to parties and to play dates, and about kind of adapting those sessions, and both for a parent of a visually impaired child, but also for other parents to adapt a session. And this is kind of, we've made a resource called Parties and Playdates, and we'll link in the comments afterwards to that. But that was kind of born out of it's really helpful for a child that those other individuals and other parents and children to know about their eye condition.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really good example, actually, the idea of helping parents and children themselves talk about their eye condition with the example of the parties and play dates. Well, in that example, what's happening is a child's life is not shrinking or being negatively affected as a consequence of the visual impairment by virtue of the fact that the parents in this example, but possibly the child too, have felt sufficiently equipped with the facts and sufficiently empowered to then discuss it with people to try and modify slightly or engineer slightly the circumstances so they're more accessible for the child. And that's mega important, because again, if those conversations don't take place, perhaps the child goes along and feels slightly excluded, or perhaps they don't feel they have the confidence to go along at all. So and helping that child to feel better engaged with their peers, in of itself, that's hugely important. And the actual process of talking about it too, I mean, I perhaps could have mentioned this in terms of, you know, writing down a little explanation to give to teachers, but by writing stuff down, by engaging with the subject, what we're trying to do therapeutically is support that child's adjustment to that condition. If something is unpleasant or aversive or even traumatic, I don't think traumatic is an unreasonable word to use in this context, you know, a new diagnosis, a sudden deterioration, however you frame it, the natural response to anything that is that unpleasant or unbearable is to run from it, essentially, is to shrink back and to avoid engaging with it. I mean, if you think about that in terms of a physical threat or something that's potentially dangerous for us, then of course we avoid it. The issue is that we as human beings tend to avoid things that are also psychologically difficult or aversive or unpleasant for us. And adjusting to any big life-changing health condition, like a visual impairment for a child or young person or adult, you know, it can be a really long process. That adjustment it can be difficult. You know, the process of talking about it, writing stuff down, engaging with people, engaging with the subject, actually, is again the first couple of steps in addressing that adjustment. When I talk about adjustment, what I suppose I'm meaning in this context is maintaining, where possible, general psychological and emotional well-being, behaving in sort of age-appropriate ways, so not regressing with regard to developmental milestones and stuff, and maintaining some sense of self-esteem and self-worth that I think we talked about in a different podcast, with the new diagnosis and all the requirements of managing it if it requires medication or eye drops or just attending appointments. So adjusting is just trying to maintain, I suppose, normal life and cope with the diagnosis. And you know, we know actually in psychology a fair amount of things about adjustment. You know, this is a topic that has been well researched and well studied for decades. You know, for a long time, the big papers and the big models in adjustment, some of them are from the 1980s. There's a couple of researchers called Lazarus and Folkman that psychologists often reach for as their go-to step one, most simple sort of model. And that model of adjustment tends to be about considering, you know, what we think about a diagnosis, what we know about it, and then kind of what we can do about it. So it's, you know, it's a bit of a two-stage process, I guess. And talking about the condition itself, talking about the visual impairment, kind of maps onto both. So appraising how harmful or difficult or challenging the thing's going to be in the model, which in this case, I suppose, is the sight loss or the visual impairment or the eye condition. And then think about, can this threat be managed or overcome by doing something, by strategies or tools or stuff we can do? So I guess if you think about it, that model. You know, what is the thing? What can we do about it? Talking about it and what form that takes really maps on really beautifully to the first step then. You know, talking about stuff. What's the condition? You know, am I going to write this thing down? It's information with my teachers. Am I going to come up with this little phrase I say to people? That is helping the child or adolescent, young person move towards this. You know, how they're going to cope with it, the sense they're going to make of it. And in doing so, I guess what we're going to hopefully promote is that idea of independence, you know, going to the parties, going doing the things, you know, staying in education, facing the challenges, hopefully overcoming whatever challenges are presented, or at least overcoming some of them as best as possible. And again, we talked about resilience in another podcast. This is sort of resilience 101 again, you know, promoting independence, facing challenges, overcoming them. So if you write the details down with the child, if they're doing it themselves, if they're talking to family members about this diagnosis, if they're using the resources that we mentioned before, you know, the website, the RNIB leaflets, the Vision Aware video, all these things, it's all moving a child in the direction of better understanding and possibly better understanding conceivably how they could overcome it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms then, obviously, you know, we've talked about how, I suppose, you know, it can cause anxiety having to talk to others about your child's eye condition from a parent's perspective, but can it be helpful for a parent to speak to others?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really struck me when we talked about meltdowns, and in fact, one of the things that struck me when we talked about the strangers coming up and asking potentially intrusive or clumsy or just rude questions, is you can't think about child or adolescent mental health without thinking about parental mental health. And you can't think about child adjustment really without thinking about parental adjustment. These things are so closely tied. And what's true of the child, you know, finding ways to approach this subject in ways that feel at least manageable, you know, that no one's going to suggest that this stuff's going to be easy, but hopefully if you can find the level appropriate resources that a child can engage with the support of an ECLO, a clinical psychologist, a member of the VI team from the local authority, you know, whichever professional is appropriate, or of course parents, we're nudging them, I guess, in the right sort of direction, even if it is quite challenging. Now, the same is true of parents. You know, if we can find ways they can engage with the subject of the VI or the eye condition in ways which feel not entirely overwhelming, it can aid that parental adjustment. Now, when we talked about the people being intrusive, sort of saying, you know, what's wrong with your child? You know, what's up with their eyes? Whatever, you know, clumsy or, you know, rude question they come up with, the completely understandable and legitimate parental response is to tell that person where to go, probably fairly abruptly. I mean, most of us would probably manage to moderate that in the moment, but frankly, who would blame a parent who didn't? Particularly if that intrusion is that abrupt. If we're trying to model to our child for reasons related to their emotional well-being, that the world is okay, you're all right, the world's fundamentally a safe place, we want to make sure that our own stuff is as under control, essentially. It's slightly more complicated than that, but, you know, is as manageable as humanly possible. So optimizing our own adjustment as a parent is mega important, and doing this process with the child. So if you're going through the information with them, you know, looking at websites, looking at resources that perhaps the optometrist or ophthalmologist or whomever has has given you, going through that with them to try and draw maybe a information sheet to give to their teachers or whatever, well, you're doing the same process. You're doing it together. Now, that's, from an attachment perspective, probably really powerful for your relationship, because you're facing challenges together and hopefully overcoming them together. You're supporting your child at a time where they perhaps need you the most. But also this subject, which for many parents feels completely overwhelming, I think it's not unreasonable to say we see as many or perhaps more parents struggling with the psychological consequences of a visual impairment or sight loss as we do children. Often children are pretty resilient. It's the parents who perhaps see the greater implications or perhaps longer term implications who perhaps would be suffering more. So actually, super appropriate, very reasonable for the parents to try and think about their own adjustment too. And that could mean doing the tasks with the child, thinking about strategies with the child or resources with the child. It could be about doing your own research. It could be about talking to other people. It could fundamentally be about acknowledging, actually, this is completely overwhelming. And if it is, and as a parent, the stress is too much actually to manage yourself? Are there people in your own life who you can call on to try and help you? Take a bit of the burden off, whatever that burden may be, which is leading to life feeling a bit overwhelming at the moment. Is it possible actually that even with that support from other family members, it's still too much? You know, is it time to think about, as I think we've mentioned in other podcasts, a bit of psychological support for yourself and talking to your GP or whatever medical or mental health professionals you may have engaged with in the past to say, look, I am struggling, knowing that if you're struggling, that may be having an impact on your child's ability to adjust to this themselves. So yeah, completely. You know, parents cannot be left out of this. Parental adjustment is also super important in determining the child's adjustment too.
Yeah. And I think it's worth mentioning too, you know, RNIB have a telephone counselling service, and it's not uncommon for parents to make use of that service as well. But also one of the, I think we get this time and time again in terms of feedback from parents who are attending maybe some of our events, but actually talking to other parents who also have a child with visual impairment. I think a lot of parents report that they find that incredibly helpful.
It's an excellent point, actually. I know that some of the issues that we've covered in these podcasts have obviously come from the parents, and I think the RNIB Facebook group, I think. Mm-hmm. And those sort of resources, you know, the professionals can only know so much. And actually, the professionals, some of the professionals may have children themselves who have a visual impairment. That perhaps might not be unusual. But even if they do, they may have had a very different experience depending on the age of that child. And there is something about having access to mm-hmm. parents who have children perhaps of a similar age with comparable or relatively similar or the same diagnosis, who have gone through this process at a roughly comparable time, even if it's perhaps a little bit ahead, and, you know, 6 months, a year, however long, because they perhaps are the ones who can offer the best advice about how to interface with services, how to get right access to the correct sort of help, you know, what resources have come out recently, actually, that are, you know, brilliant, that perhaps people who've looked months or perhaps years ago wouldn't have access to. So yeah, that's a really, really good point. There's a really important place for online or in person, but perhaps online groups, Facebook groups, forums, where you can talk to other parents who have had perhaps children or have children with similar diagnoses to see what guidance they could perhaps give.
Yeah, the RNIB Facebook group can be found by searching on Facebook for RNIB Parent and Carers. And as you were saying, Ian, there's a lot of specific condition groups out there as well. So if you wanted more information on that, if you're listening and thinking that would be useful, please feel free to get in touch with us, and our contact details are at the end of this podcast. Again, lots of information, Ian. Really important subjects. And I guess in closing, what we're saying is it can be really important for both a child and for the parents and carers to take that step in terms of telling other people about their eye condition, and it can be a positive one with the right support in place. Thank you again, Ian, for joining us, and thank you for those listening. Please feel free to check out other podcasts and join us for more in the future. See you later.
If you found this helpful, you can listen to further podcasts in this series. You can find additional information at rnib.org.uk/children or email our team directly on cypf@rnib.org.uk. You can also call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999, and for further information on Fight Against Blindness, visit fightagainstblindness.org. Standing with you through every challenge, RNIB see differently.